Welcome to this introduction to the New Vic Theatre's latest production, One Man, Two Governors. I'm Pam Beach, and I'll be audio describing the show, along with Brenda Hennessy, on Saturday the 11th of May at 2:15pm. The touch tour will start at 1:15. We'll meet you in the foyer in front of the box office a few minutes beforehand. The first half of the show lasts almost an hour and a half, and the second half an hour. There'll be a 20-minute interval. One Man, Two Governors by Richard Bean is based on The Servant of Two Masters by Carlo Goldoni, with songs by Grant Olding. This new production is directed by Conrad Nelson. Set in Brighton in 1963, we follow what Francis Henschel gets up to when he's sacked from his band. A cocktail of mistaken identity, mayhem, music, fast-paced physical comedy and silliness make One Man, Two Governors one of the great British comedies of the 21st century. In case you haven't visited this theatre before, I'll now tell you about the auditorium where the play is performed, before I describe the set and locations. The New Vic is a theatre in the round, so the audience surrounds a circular stage. Tiered, purple upholstered seats rise all around the flat circular stage, which is approximately 10 metres in diameter. Three evenly spaced entrances lead up onto the stage. Two are used by actors and audiences, and the third, slightly larger main entrance, is used only by actors. Thinking of a clock face, if the main entrance is at 12 o'clock, the other two entrances are at 4 and 8 o'clock. During the audio description, we'll name the 4 o'clock entrance the right entrance and the 8 o'clock entrance the left entrance. By the main entrance at 1 o'clock and by the left entrance at 9 o'clock, there is a section of acting space we call a notch. Behind the audience seating is a circular pathway known as the promenade. Five sets of aisle steps lead down from it to the stage. The aisles and promenade are used by both audience and actors, as in this show. In the aisles at the end of each row of seats, there are small handrails to assist ascent and descent. Perched above the promenade is a balcony edged with a safety barrier and housing two rows of seats. Fixed high above the stage is a large lighting rig, complete with walkways known as the grid. Props may be stowed or suspended from here. As you take your seat in this auditorium, you'll hear the sound of seagulls, and a bright, minimalistic set will be before you. A red and yellow Brighton sign hangs above the stage, and a group of four white seagulls fly high in front of each entrance. A large number of characters, a band, a variety of locations, and the need for swinging doors provided the challenge for our designer, Liz Evans, in this rare, in-the-round staging of the play. She took inspiration from 1960s colours, fabrics and interiors, and the seaside town of Brighton itself, with its promenade and pier. Choosing a palette of light pastel colours, the stage floor is covered in printed, vintage-style vinyl that extends out into all the entrances. It's patterned in geometric stripes, squares and circles in colours of yellow, pale blue and turquoise, pops of light red and a little grey and brown in the background. Although the floor looks even and seamless, a rectangular part, centre stage, about 1.5 metres by 2.5, actually folds down out of the stage floor into the trap as a staircase of seven treads. This happens in a couple of scenes, but more about that later. The pale blue colour and pattern of the painted metal railings along the seafront on Brighton's promenade are a general feature of this set's design. About waist height, the railings look weathered to be authentic for the seaside. The backing panels of the notches are painted in their colour and outline. About 15 minutes before the show starts, whilst the audience is still gathering, actors saunter in, most carrying musical instruments. They casually chat to folk as they wander and spread out over the stage, forming a band. You will then be entertained with a few songs, the first of many throughout the show, linking in to the play's storyline. Dancing, jiving, general moving to the music goes on too. By the time you leave the theatre, you'll have heard lots of different instruments played, from percussion, a washboard, even spoons, to a saxophone, violin, and a double bass. From time to time, three chrome mic stands are used by the band and singers. The musicians often play in varying group sizes and sometimes solo on a platform constructed as a bandstand above the main entrance. The platform has a semicircular podium extension at the front and is enclosed by railings. Access to the platform is from the promenade behind it. Two circular pictures on the pale blue back wall are blown-up postcards of Brighton bandstand and pier. The same style podiums also extend over the other two entrances, above white-framed double doors, hinged to swing both ways. In the upper part of each pale blue door, there's a round window. These doors, and identical ones at the main entrance, are pinned back until needed in particular scenes. A line of coloured festoon lights decorates the front of all three podiums, and similar lights hang round the front of the balcony. At times, the lights flash in various colour sequences or glow in one colour. In the flowing and dynamic setting of the round, the locations are simply represented. Scene changes are mostly choreographed, actors dancing as they move furniture and props, accompanied by the band playing and a song. The seagull's wings flap during some scene changes. The play opens in the living room of Charlie Clench's house. A celebration for his daughter Pauline's engagement to Alan is taking place. A hand-painted congratulations banner is tied across the main entrance. A patch with the name Alan on has been added to cover another name, but it slipped and the letter R can be seen. Positioned at 9 o'clock, there's a small formica table on which dishes of remaining buffet food, like cheese on sticks and sausage rolls, sit alongside two bottles of champagne and glasses. A dining chair with a cream seat stands beside the table. Opposite, across the room, is a small oval occasional table with another dining chair to one side and an armchair to the other side. The armchair is covered in a faded beige fabric of similar pattern to the floor covering. On the table is a framed photograph of Queen Elizabeth II as a young woman. Scene 2 takes place outside the Cricketer's Arms. The pub sign hangs above the stage at 3 o'clock. It's painted green with white lettering, a cricket bat and leg pad cross behind a wicket, and a cricket ball. An old beer barrel is brought in and two metal dustbins. Only one has a lid. Dregs of drinks remain in a few glasses on top of the barrel, and there's an ashtray. Beside the barrel is a slatted, faded blue bench with a beer glass left on it. Two authorization letters in brown envelopes, two letters in white envelopes, and a bulky envelope of cash are other props in this scene. Scene 3 is in Charlie's house. The location of the last scene of Act 1 is a first floor aperitif bar between two private dining rooms at the Cricketers' Arms. The pinned back swing double doors are released, and lettering on the closed doors show that at the right entrance they are the doors to the Bradman room and at the left entrance to the Compton room. Characters frequently to and fro through these swing doors. In the notch at 9 o'clock is a life-size plywood cut-out representation of W.G. Grace, poised at a wicket, with his face cut away. Three signed cricket bats hang on the wall of the 1 o'clock notch. There's a circular table at 2 o'clock, covered in a floor-length white tablecloth. On it are two stacks of white plates and a wooden cutlery box. The centre of the stage floor is lowered, like pull-down loft steps, to make a staircase down to the ground floor and kitchen. Railings are secured at right angles to each other along two edges of the stairwell. Both of the governors Francis finds himself serving bring similar heavy trunks edged in black, one cream and the other light grey. In this scene, lots of dishes of food are carried in. Soup in a lidded tureen, dishes of cold meats, antipasti, chicken balls, roast potatoes, a crown of lamb and three trout on a wooden board with a pot of flaked almonds. A metal food trolley is wheeled in with dishes of vegetables, a bottle of wine and more plates. Ingredients for a crepe Suzette and equipment to make it are brought. Other props used in this chaotic scene are napkins, menus and wine lists, a corkscrew, a sweeping brush, a mouse trap and a fire extinguisher. You'll need an interval break at this point in the show. 5 minutes before the end of the interval, the band will resume playing on the bandstand. The stairwell is no longer there, and the stage cleared. Act 2 opens round the back of Charlie's house. The stage is empty. Charlie's scrap metal trading sign hangs at 9 o'clock, oval in shape and rust in colour. Props here are an ordinary knife from Woolworths and a flick knife. The pub forecourt is the next location, followed by the corridor between the rooms the governors occupy. Props used in the corridor are an iron and ironing board at 6 o'clock, a small pile of iron shirts, and a jumble of clothes in the two trunks placed either side of the ironing board. Amongst the clothes in one trunk is a framed photograph of a graduate. A large red diary, a few papers protruding from it, lies on top of the clothes in the other trunk. Subtle lighting projections of lapping sea on the floor herald the next location, Brighton Pier. The centre of the stage descends into the trap for the sea. A railing is fixed beside it for the end of the pier. A 2-metre-tall post installed near the middle of the railing is the lower part of a lamp post. The top of an ornate Victorian metal lamp post with two lights, a replica of those in Brighton, hangs high above the post. Props in this scene are a boat ladder at the end of the pier, an escape ladder to descend below the podium of the bandstand, a travel brochure and a red rose. Finally, it's back to where we started, in the living room in Charlie's house. The armchair has been replaced by a third dining chair and the table by a buffet. Francis Henschel has had an eventful time with two governors. More about him and the actors now from Brenda, as she tells you about the characters and costumes.
Well, I think I'll start with the band. At some time in the show, all of the actors sing and play musical instruments. And in this fast-paced show, the men, stepping in to play, just about have time to put on a rather cheap-looking pale blue or yellow tuxedo jacket, finished with black satin lapels. And it's deliberately cheap-looking, because in the 1960s, the End of the Pier show's intention was to provide cheap, light entertainment for pure amusement. When the women step in or out of the band, they stay in their characters' outfits. There is an exception, though. In Act 2, three of the women form a close harmony trio to entertain us. And if you're as old as me, think Beverly Sisters and their matching outfits. Our trio wear sleeveless cotton summer dresses. The pattern fabric sourced for the dresses is called Tutti Frutti, suggesting maybe a colourful confectionery of chopped fruits. The pattern is made up of yellow, blue and red geometric shapes, some shapes sliced and multicoloured, toned down a little with grey shapes. Each dress has a fitted bodice and full skirt that falls to just below the knee. A small, neat matching bow is sewn at the neckline. Red pointed court shoes trimmed with the dress fabric bow finish the outfit. The irrepressible Michael Hugo plays Francis Henshaw. Yes, he is the man with two governors. Francis is in his 30s, maybe 40s. By the end of the show, definitely more 40s than 30s. Of slight build with short brown hair. He wears a loud mustard orange and brown, bold checked two-piece slim-cut suit with contrasting waistcoat. Over a white shirt and brown patterned tie, he darts about, fraught and frenzied, in brown brogues. Francis sports a brown bowler hat when he comes on as an Irish friend, Paddy. Charlie Clench, also known as Charlie the Duck, played by Howard Chadwick, is a dodgy scrap metal dealer. Charlie's in his 50s, of medium height but overweight. His brown hair greying at the temples is combed into a quiff. Sideburns and a small moustache complete his look. He wears an olive green checked, late 50s two-piece suit. The trousers held up with braces, over a yellow shirt with pattern tie, held back with a tie clip. Later he wears a beige cardigan with the suit trousers. In an outdoor scene he dons a car coat and trilby. Charlie's bubbly daughter Pauline is played by Alice Libbard. Pauline is 18 and of slim build. Her mid-length dark curly hair is held back with a headband. She wears a pop of blue eyeshadow, black winged eyeliner and pink lipstick. Before the show starts, she sings with the band. She wears the sleeveless cotton dress mentioned earlier, but teamed with a matching cropped three-quarter length jacket and neat white lace-up shoes. Later, she wears a short-sleeved turquoise patterned top with pale blue cropped trousers and the white lace-ups. For outdoors, she dons a short fuchsia pink mat. Harry Dangle is played by Jonathan Markwood. Harry is Charlie's solicitor. He stands upright and adopts a rather straight-laced expression. He's in his late 50s. He's tall and slim with short brown hair. He wears a navy two-piece suit over a blue waistcoat, black bow tie and brown brogues. He wears heavy framed glasses. Later he wears a stone-coloured gabardine raincoat. And as one of two policemen, Jonathan Markwood wears a 1960s uniform and wields a truncheon. Harry's theatrical son, Alan Dangle, is played by Thomas Cotran. His actions are deliberate and exaggeratedly dramatic and emotional. Audiences find this funny. He's in his late 20s and is of average height and build. His brown hair is brushed forward into a Beatles-style mop, and he has a beard he describes as pretentious. He wears slim-cut burgundy corduroy trousers teamed with a pink silk shirt, cravat and brown Chelsea boots. Later he wears a green, snug-fitting polo neck jumper, neckerchief and a brown suede jacket and fisherman's cap. Lloyd Boateng is played by Declan Wilson, a friend to Charlie and owner and chef at the Cricketers Arms. He's in his mid-50s and from Jamaica. He's tall, of medium build and has balding short black hair. He wears a 1950s light brown checked cotton jacket and full brown wool trousers over a pale striped shirt, all topped with a pork pie hat. Later, dressed as the chef, he wears a long-sleeved white chef's jacket, a white apron over brown trousers, and a tall white chef's hat and a yellow neckerchief. Roscoe Crabb and twin sister Rachel are both played by Lucinda Freeburn. Rachel as Roscoe is in his 20s. To try and convince others that he is Roscoe, he struts about, sits with knees wide apart, and occasionally clutches his groin. He's of slim build and average height, for a woman. He wears an auburn wig with a blunt-cut fringe, just like Ringo Starr. Roscoe wears an amber and green shot Italian suit over a white shirt, braces and patterned tie and tan shoes. Later as Rachel, she wears an emerald green dress. It's sleeveless, has a fitted bodice with shawl collar and a full skirt that falls to just below the knee, worn with red flat slingback shoes. Stanley Stubbers, played by Gareth Cooper, is a public school posh toff. He strides about with head held high, set at an angle, as if his brain is trying to fathom something out. He's in his late 20s. He's tall, of average build, with light brown floppy hair. He wears a navy blazer and white cricket trousers over a pastel striped shirt, braces and red cravat. Later he sports a white corduroy fisherman's cap. Alfie, an elderly waiter, is played by Nick Haverson. He's in his late 80s. He's fitted with a battery-operated wearable pacemaker. Yes, it's worn externally. It's attached to a white belt worn over his trousers, and it has a reachable dial. Now that's asking for trouble. He's old, and everything from facial expressions to physical movements reiterates that. His wrinkled forehead and turned-down mouth, his uncoordinated and doddery footsteps. He's short, of medium build, and very, very stooped. Years have curved his bones and made him shrink. His clothes don't fit him anymore. His wild hair is thin and greying, and he has facial stubble. He wears a white cotton drill cropped waiter's jacket and black trousers over a white shirt and braces and a black bow tie. Later, he wears a double-breasted, stone-coloured waistcoat. Briefly, playing a nosy old woman, he wears a pale blue mac, headscarf, and pulls along a shopping trolley. Gareth, the barman and head waiter at the Cricketer's Arms, is played by Daniel Miles. He's in his early 30s, is of average height and build. His brown hair is a short back and sides with a quiff. He wears a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up, a grey waistcoat, black trousers and black shoes. When serving, he dons a white cotton drill, cropped waiter's jacket and black bow tie. Daniel Miles also plays a taxi driver. He wears a stone-coloured bomber jacket over a grey V-neck jumper, white shirt, black trousers and shoes, and a flat cap. As one of the two policemen, he wears a 1960s uniform and wields a truncheon. Dolly, played by Jessica Dias, is Charlie's bookkeeper. She's in her mid-40s, of average height, and her shape exaggerated with structured underwear. Her hair, Jessica herself describes it as very high, set up and curled up do, slightly dated, very done and comical. Liz Evans, the designer, calls it an extreme wig. Her walk is a deliberate, exaggerated wiggle to comical effect. She wears a V-necked blue satin cocktail dress, teamed with blue stiletto court shoes, bracelets, necklace, earrings, and lots of makeup. Later, Dolly wears an olive and gold silk Chanel suit over a yellow and pink spotted blouse, with a necktie and gold court shoes, and carries a Welsh tapestry handbag. Now please listen on for the creative team. Conrad Nelson, director. Liz Evans, designer. Rebecca Hughes, musical director. Daniela Beatty, lighting designer, Simon Deacon, sound designer, Beverly Norris Edmonds, movement director and choreographer, Nick Haverson, physical comedy consultant, Angie Carroll, casting associate, Kenan Ali, fight director, and Mandeep Glover, assistant director. We hope you enjoyed the show.